This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, this is Best Practice. I'm Richard Adey. Managing growth is one of the big challenges facing small enterprises. Going from startup to successful medium-sized enterprise is bloody hard. So later in the show, we'll catch up with the researcher finding out how successful businesses have negotiated this transition. We first spoke to her last year when she was beginning this project. She knows a lot more now. It's worth hearing. Board accountability. That's one of the water cooler topics while the Banking Royal Commission rolls along. How should boards be functioning so that they have a clear oversight of a company's activities, both good and bad? Not by appointing mates to the board, according to the woman you're about to meet. You'd think that was obvious, wouldn't you? And yet research by Shireen Smith suggests that that's what typically happens. Shireen teaches ethics and governance and business at RMIT, and her PhD thesis, still in the works, is evaluating board recruitment practices. She joins me now. Shireen, welcome to Best Practice.
Thank you so much for having me, Richard.
Before we talk about your work, just remind us of what we already know about the makeup of boards.
Studies have reported, and analysis by AICD shows a 80-20 percentage, females being the minority on boards.
Right. So that's the Australian Institute of Company Directors, 18% right. On ASX 100 companies, I think. I mean, it's barely moved, hasn't it? And that's despite a lot of awareness about this now.
There's been a lot of awareness about it. And I mean, governing bodies, organizational stakeholders have really tried to push this forward. But in Australia, what we have is a principles-based system. So it's not mandated. Right. So when you compare Australia to other regions like Norway, which have actually passed a law that actually prescribes that you have a minimum 40% on boards, in Australia, it's completely different. It's very discretionary. It's a comply and explain principle. So if you do not comply, you explain, you give reasons. And so this gives a lot of flexibility to persons that are actually structuring boards at the moment.
Now, that, I suppose, is the baseline. Now, you've been looking at something slightly different, haven't you? What have you been examining?
I wanted to find out, how did we get here? Because, you know, let's take a step back from what the composition is saying, but what do we actually know about board recruitment? And what you found was that there is a nebulous understanding of how persons got onto boards. And so, you know, my first focus was, how does one become a director? How do you get onto boards?
So you actually went out and talked to a lot of directors, didn't you?
So I spoke to 20 directors, and this range, and, you know, these are persons that have been on boards for as long as 40 years. So I had some very experienced company directors on various types of boards that were able to give me some insight. And what you found was there were two narratives that came through from those discussions. So when you ask persons, you know, how did you get onto board? You know, they'll say, I was recruited because of my marketing expertise or my accounting expertise. But then when you started to ask, okay, so what happens when you are recruiting other persons for boards? And then you started to get those idiosyncrasies that said, okay, you need to know someone, you need to belong to this particular network. You know, the board decided that we would rather have people we know than people we don't know.
Right. So that means that it actually limits your set of potential board recruits, doesn't it?
So it really is primarily what the study found is that board recruitment is done from a closed network, right? So the pool of candidates are very much limited. Whatever human capital that our qualifications that we speak about, it's really limited to those social circles or those networks that these boards are recruiting from.
What's the process then?
So the process explained to me is that when a vacancy comes up, the first thing that they do is they ask around the table, who knows someone?
Right.
And then based on that, they'll have an informal meeting. They'll ring up the person, have a informal meeting to find out, you know, their availability, their interests, what their skill set is. Now, there is some validation in all of that for skill set. But one of the things that I want the listeners to understand is that when you are recruiting from a closed circle, qualifications is relative because you don't have anything to compare that to. So you don't really know if you're getting the best candidate for the job. And so what I found is that conversations about qualification, it's more of, you know, using a legal term here, it's an ex post facto rationalization of recruitment decisions. So after the fact.
Yeah.
So if you put me onto a board, you know, my rationalization for being on that board would be that, okay, I have 15 years experience being an accountant. I have background in ethics and governance. And so that becomes the rationalization. But that is not the primary reason why I got onto this board in the first place. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I am the best candidate for the job.
So our board members, and you mentioned you talked to 20 of them.
Yes.
Is everybody comfortable with this process? Because it seems to be very limiting.
Well, the interesting thing about that, Richard, was that the female directors, they were more opposed to it, but then they are the minority on boards. You know, I heard coming through from the female directors was that, you know, we were opposed to it. We're not casting the net wide enough. And you also found that persons were actually allowed to stay on longer on boards than it was beneficial. So after a while, even that qualification or experience or expertise that you're talking about, you know, becomes counterproductive depending on what is going on. And this primarily happens because if they're not able to identify, you know, a suitable replacement within that particular network, then persons stay on longer than beneficial for organizations. So while the female directors, they have a problem, and if we back up a bit, we have a existing issue, you know, from the 80s that, you know, has really influenced what has been going on boards with these old boy networks. So you find that persons, you know, that have these associations from the grammar schools and all those kinds of networks and, you know, alumni, they have dominated, these males have dominated boards, and they have all these business connections and different relationships. And so this is where the problem started in the first place. And so now while you have that 20% of females getting onto boards at the moment, what you find is that they are not really influential.
I've actually had people on boards tell me that the problem with, I suppose, being encouraged to, being made to recruit women, being made to recruit people who are different, is that they don't have the skills. They're kind of saying they don't have the skills or experience. They're just there because we're supposed to be targeting diversity. They've actually said that to me.
Well, there's a bit of tokenism going on, because what you find when you recommend a principle or a rule, then there's somewhat of a checkbox kind of approach. And I found that in my discussions that, okay, we need to have 20%. And so let's check that box. But a focus, and, you know, I don't want anyone to misunderstand, it's very important that there is a focus on diversity, but it's how it's being done. Because what we currently have right now is a diversity paradox, what I call a diversity paradox, where you have, you know, studies and reports from the AICD saying that, listen, more women are getting onto boards and we have more skill diversity, but we do not have actual diversity, because all you're finding is this checkbox approach to make sure that we meet the minimum requirement. And so you're getting the females onto boards, but they're being recruited from these same social networks.
Right. So they're just as connected as the men on the boards.
They are just as connected as the men. So you get this diversity paradox where you're not actually getting diverse boards by this approach. Now, I want to just make a comparison to what happened in Norway in 2007 when they passed that act. What happened? You know, so this debate that we don't have enough qualified female, that is not necessarily the case. When Norway passed that act, what studies found afterwards were that females that came onto boards after the Act was passed were far more qualified than their predecessors.
So for boards and for the companies they're in charge of, the issue is not whether this is not fair to women or not fair to parts of Australia that are not properly and fully represented. The issue is, do they have an effective board? And the research is pretty clear on this. You need diverse voices.
You need diverse voices because, you know, boards have been dominated by this, you know, groupthink mentality. And I found that in the interviews also, that persons were very much concerned to go against the status quo. I have been told by several directors in that interview that diversity causes conflict. So we are much more comfortable with persons like ourselves. And this is the problem. So even though you're getting the females coming through, they are still from these same social circles. And so there is this understanding and conformance to the status quo. So no one is really challenging or changing what is currently happening on boards.
That means, I suppose, that if you're on that board, that you want a harmonious board, perhaps rather than an effective board.
And this is part of the problem, because we need to also evaluate what is the role of a board? What do they set out to achieve? I also found that there were so many different perspectives as what it is. And so the conversations have been dominated primarily by this profit maximization focus, this shareholder focus kind of thing. But we find that this is not working, because the governing aspect of it, the oversight, the risk assessment, all of those factors are not being taken care of at the moment.
Interestingly, if you look at boards in countries like Germany, they will often have scientists on boards. So somebody with a completely different perspective to the usual background, which is in things like law and accounting and running the business anyway.
And I'm happy you made mention of that, because a colleague of mine has been doing extensive study on the German system. And persons don't understand that there's an alternate model. So what we have is this one-tier board system in the, you know, the Anglo-English-speaking world. And in Germany and in Netherlands, the Dutch system, it's a two-tier kind of system. And what you have is representation from different persons. So you have a supervisory board where you have, you know, that's completely independent directors on that, employees, workers' council, you have a management board. And so you have a wider cross-section of persons, and you have representation from all key organizational stakeholders. And it makes much of a difference.
Shireen, thank you very much for joining me today.
It was my pleasure.
In May last year, I met Danielle Logue, who's an associate professor at UTS Business School. She runs the Australian leg of the Growth Project, and she has some results. So, time to get her back in the studio. Danielle, give us a quick reminder. What is the Growth Project?
The Growth Project is an international research collaboration, and we're looking at how firms scale and how they deal with rapid growth. We know it's chaotic, we know it's really hard, but we wanted to really investigate that process and trying to see if there's any patterns available or some lessons that we could share with people who are dealing with this.
So there's other countries too, aren't there? What are they?
There's Australia, Canada, a few firms in the US, the Netherlands, Pakistan, Israel, and now Argentina is joining as well, because there's a lot of, countries interested in these high growth firms. They're really drivers of growth in the economy and jobs as well.
Interesting that, because we're talking different regulatory environments, different economies, different cultures, and yet all of those places and lots of others as well are trying to get this stuff to happen.
Yeah, this is really, I think, a strength of being in an international research collaboration, where we can look across all of these contexts. So when you see common issues and problems and common responses, it's really powerful.
The firms you're looking at, they've already been like really successful, but they're still at the beginning.
Well, we actually looked at a range of firms, and actually from speaking with you previously, we had a lot more firms contacted us. So in our sample in Australia, some of the firms are 8 years old, so have just experienced the growth period or are still going through it, and other firms are 30 and 40 years old, who could share some reflections on what it was like, what happened next, and, you know, maybe what things would they have done differently.
When you were recruiting, you were after firms that had done 30% growth year on year over 2 or 3 years.
Yes. So 30% growth, period of 3 years or more year on year to understand that really high growth, chaotic period.
Yep.
But the firms we had had just experienced it or could reflect back on that. So we really opened up our sample to get a broad range of experiences.
All right. So what can you tell me about how the Australian businesses are going?
So the Australian businesses had similar issues, of course, to our international sample. So it was good for us to input into the global study. And there were 8 key points that came through in these issues of scaling, some lessons learned that we can share.
Well, okay, I'll get you to take me through them. The first one is begin with the end in mind. Now, that makes sense, I have to say.
Yes. So what we actually saw was if some of these startups or businesses spent a bit of time thinking about what was their longer term objective, did they want to exit, did they want to go for an IPO, or did they want to maintain control and build out a family dynasty for their business, that was actually a helpful to keep in mind when they were making decisions about what type of financing should they take on. Should they take on venture capitalist financing or angel investment, which meant giving up a share of their equity? So if you're thinking about that, which is an easy, you think it's an obvious thing, but not often that happens when you start to go into this growth period. If they could think about that, that could really help guide their decisions and I guess not make it an easier scaling process, but reduce them pulling their hair out along the way.
You also found things about that scaling process itself, didn't you?
Right. So a couple of the tips that we were sharing was that firms that were thinking in terms of their business model were doing things a little bit better than firms that hadn't. So what I mean by that is we call it nail it, then scale it. So think about, you know, you understand that you're delivering value, but can you deliver that value consistently as you scale? Is there a chance to think about your business model? And we suggest in the business school, we use this in a lot of our courses, the business model canvas, which is a one-page map and you can search for it online. But it really lays out who are the customers, who are the suppliers, what's your value proposition? And thinking about, you know, what are the assumptions in that as you scale? Are you relying on one customer? Are you relying on one supplier? What's going to happen if you scale and you're too dependent on them perhaps?
Well, actually, that gets us to the third, I suppose, finding, which is that if the business model's not working out, you've got to be prepared to change.
Right. So we call this pivot with purpose. And I always think of netball when I think of this, which then means I have to explain this to my international colleagues about netball. So we know in netball that, you know, pivoting means you keep one foot in place and you use your other foot to spin in a bit of a different direction. And pivoting is a common term in the startup world. But we found that firms needed to, I guess, pivot because it was extremely valuable, but it's also extremely costly as well. And a lot of entrepreneurs and founders told us that they're really alert to all these different opportunities. Sometimes they said yes to too many things and went in too many different directions. So pivoting with purpose was really about maintaining some coherence when you actually change direction and thinking about your core value proposition.
Yeah, going back to that first thing, which is beginning with the end in mind.
Yes.
Yeah. Now, the next one I think is perhaps one of the really tricky ones, because this is really about founders, the people who start these businesses. And we have to remind ourselves, people who start businesses have energy and ambition, and they kind of know what they want to do. And what you're saying is learn to delegate.
This is one of the most crucial points and just one of the hardest of letting it go as you grow. And as you mentioned, the founders and in our sample, actually, a lot of the founders were still involved. And it's really like when you're starting out your baby, you're very close to your customers or your technology. It's hard to actually let go of some of those decision-making processes, but you really need to. And it's an anecdote that we use in different courses in the business school, a classic one of Michael Dell of Dell Computing, who says when he was scaling his businesses, one of his employees came up to him and said, I've lost my quarter in the vending machine. And he said, why on earth are you telling me this? He said, well, you're the only one with the key to the vending machine. So this micromanaging is a tough thing to let go of, but really important. And another part of this letting go while you grow was thinking about where do you go to for advice? And we had a terrific response from our previous conversation with firms and founders all over the country writing to us saying, we really need help. We need people to turn to. Sometimes turning to family and friends isn't always as helpful. Maybe they haven't experienced it, or maybe they're already annoyed with you for spending such an intense amount of time trying to scale the business. And a couple of firms in our Australian sample created what was a strategic advisory board. So not a formal board of the company, but a bunch of people who they often paid to actually come together quarterly, or who could take phone calls when needed about how to scale the business. Maybe it was about IT issues, maybe it was about distribution, things like that. Maybe it was about HR issues. So that was a particularly helpful source.
This is kind of professional mentoring in a way.
Yes. And that's really what's happening in these firms, moving from a scrappy startup where you might be wearing your hoodie and so on, to transitioning to a more formally or professionally managed enterprise, which you need to do to manage the challenges of scaling.
Now, I think something that's related to letting go as you grow, the delegation thing, is the next finding, which is about who you hire. And you say it's really important to be prepared to hire people who are smarter than you.
I know. I guess it's a classic. It's not always just relevant for scaling, but it is a difficult thing to do. And this people agility, as we describe it, is just getting the right people as you grow. And this was really the core focus of a lot of the Australian firms and one of the challenges that they had there. When you're moving from a startup to scaling, you're often looking for not generalists, but specialists. And we found that some of the Australian firms, to get the right people, they went overseas or they had to hire people on the other side of the country, which was terrific that they found them. But then it immediately meant that they had to change their organisational structure or their decision-making processes, their communication processes as well. But definitely getting the right people, the people that had shared similar values or had what we describe as a growth mindset, that were okay with doing things on the fly or working things out as you go and moving towards that more formal process, was particularly valuable.
We talked about growth mindset on Best Practice not that long ago, actually, and it's the thing that characterizes it is how you deal with failure or when things don't work out, rather than, just to remind people, rather than being, well, I thought I was brilliant and it hasn't worked, more, okay, that hasn't worked, I can learn how not to stuff it up next time.
Yes, exactly. That's a key part of it. And also what we found through talking with our different entrepreneurs was this notion of big company people and small company people,
right,
and trying to get that right mix. So often it's when you hire people from, say, the larger tech firms, for example, who are used to a lot of structures, processes, policies in place and a bit more order, they struggle sometimes with a rapidly growing firm when there might not be enough of a job description perhaps, or reporting lines are being worked out on the fly. And then same again for people that have maybe only worked in startups, that are almost antagonistic towards having to have a sign off and filling out a few forms and things on the way.
Okay, that gets us to the next one really, doesn't it? Which is about the processes and structures that you put in place.
Yeah, this is a big bone of contention across the international sample, how you build out this scaffolding for your growth. So the real technical stuff, the IT systems, the human resource management systems, operating policies, everything like that, that you do need to start building out as you grow. I mean, we had a lot of founders speaking with us saying, gosh, I'm a tech person and I've got this great company and now I'm having to spend my weekends reading industrial relations, legislation and working out HR systems and things like that. And we saw a lot of the Australian firms actually doing what we describe as a light touch formalization. So they were moving towards implementing some of these systems, but they kept it fairly agile. I hate using that word, but
agile. You mean ad hoc? You mean ad hoc?
Exactly.
Don't you?
Well, instead of having a 100-page strategic plan, they did have a 1 or 2-page plan, right, to give people a sense of, right, this is the direction that we're heading in, this is our identity, and so on. But working out what IT system to get is a real issue. A lot of the time, the IT system you start with doesn't enable you to grow as far, or you've customized it and that part doesn't enable you to grow. So that's a real problem area.
All right. Is it all over, done, dusted now? What happens?
So we are still growing our sample. We'd love to speak to more firms across Australia as well. We've got new countries joining the international study too. And I just think the more data that we can have, we could start making comparisons across different industries, different sectors, between firms that have gone public compared to firms that have maintained, say, family ownership, and start pulling out some of the key differences and insights there. So we're going to keep on going.
And if people want to get in touch, how do they do that?
They can certainly contact me at UTS. If you just search for the Growth Project UTS, that will pop up for you.
Thanks very much for coming back in. It's good to hear how things are going, Danielle.
Thanks so much for your support. A pleasure.
Associate Professor Danielle Logue is at UTS Business School. That's it for this week. Best Practice is produced by Mudita Dias and Anne Arnold. Our sound engineer is Hamish Camilleri. I'm Richard Adie.